Quel est le point de départ?
Hello, wrestling fans, and welcome to Shut Up and Wrestle, a wrestling history podcast about good conversations and great stories. I am your host, Brian R. Solomon, and this is episode 119 with my guest, Brad Baluchian, the author of the brand new wrestling book, The Six Pack, On the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. A great book, great guy, and I'm going to be taking you to that in a moment. Just wanted to mention a few things. I want, once again, if you'll forgive me, to plug and mention the Patreon that I've really gotten going or been getting off the ground, the Shut Up and Wrestle commentaries. I mentioned it on last week's show, and I see that some people have already signed up either as free members just to check out the free sample that I put on there, the commentary for the St. Patrick's Day 1975 Worldwide Wrestling Federation Madison Square Garden event. And there have been a few paid subscribers as well. I'm very grateful for that. As I mentioned last week, the project is intended to be a series of commentaries that I am recording for historic wrestling cards, kind of like a watch-along or an old-school DVD commentary that you can listen to while you watch the event. The Patreon is patreon.com/shutupandwrestle, because of course it is. If you're curious about the project, do go there. I hope people take a liking to it. I'm going to be starting the premium tier of the series very soon, where I intend to do at least one of these commentaries a month, for the low, low subscription price of $5. Five buckaroos, a Mickey Finn, as we used to call it. So anyway, check it out, patreon.com/shutupandwrestle if you want to find out more about the Shut Up and Wrestle Commentaries Project. Also, Pro Wrestling Illustrated's brand new issue, the July issue, is going on sale Thursday, May 9th, which is the day after this episode drops. And it's one that I think old school fans are going to get a kick out of. If you remember the old Super Cards issues that Pro Wrestling Illustrated used to do, this is a throwback. It's the 2024 Super Cards issue of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Inside, I've got a couple of columns. My lockup column takes a look at how WWE is bringing back the term professional wrestling and phasing out sports entertainment, which for a lot of us is something that we have been kind of dreaming and hoping for a very long time. And in my other column, my retro column, The Way It Was, I take a look at the life and legacy of Thunderbolt Patterson, of course, a member of the brand new 2024 WWE Hall of Fame class. So I do suggest you check that out. It goes on sale digitally on May 9th. And that you can find at pwi-online.com. The print edition will be going on sale later this month. I'll let you guys know when that happens. But right now, I'd like to take you to this week's interview. Brad's book, The Six Pack on the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania, is a fascinating read, unlike any other wrestling book you've ever read. And it was a pleasure to speak to him. A lot of great stories in this conversation about sort of behind the scenes in WWE, the corporate side of things, the creative side of things. I even share a few of my own stories that I don't think I've ever shared before, including the time that Vince McMahon was first pitched the Legends program in WWE. So I hope you enjoyed this fun conversation, and I'm going to take you to it right now. Okay, so it's my pleasure this week on Shut Up and Wrestle to welcome someone to the show who is the author of, I'm not the first person to say this, but a very different kind of wrestling book. And it's one that I am very glad that I got a hold of, and it's excellent and it's unique. And he's been making the rounds on some other shows that you guys, especially on Arcadian Vanguard, might have been listening to. He's recently been on the Jim Cornette Experience. He's been on Stick to Wrestling. He's a journalist. He's a scientist. He is the only wrestling author that I could think of who has discovered 17 species of insect. He is Brad Balukchian. Brad, thank you so much for making the time to do the show.
Thanks so much, Brian. I'm really happy to be here today to chat with you.
And while I'm at it, it probably would be a good idea to mention the title of the book. It's called The Six-Pack on the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. And you've got a cover that would endear you to any 1980s wrestling kid, because it's three very well-worn LJN rubber figures doing battle. It's Iron Sheik, Hulk Hogan, and I'm trying for the life of me to figure out the third guy. Is it Tito Santana?
Yeah, that's Tito coming in with a flying forearm.
There you go. Yeah. The flying burrito, as Bobby Heenan used to call it.
Right.
But anyway, yes, this book is like, it's the ultimate wrestling rabbit hole. Because, and again, I'm trying not to cover ground that's been covered, because I listened to the John McAdam interview, I listened to Cornette, and both were excellent. I have had some experiences with some of the people that you spoke to in the book, so I'm definitely interested to talk a little bit about that. And I mentioned before we started about how some of it was very relevant to the book I'm researching right now, the life of Gorilla Monsoon, Irresistible Force. But I also want to say, too, really quickly, that I like the way it's structured with it's essentially a series of essays, right, where you're tracking down these specific wrestlers and getting their stories, and not just wrestlers, actually, but because it, like, for example, in the Vince chapter and elsewhere, you talk to former Titan Sports people, which that always gets a reaction out of me, because I feel like, you know, I worked there for 7 years, and we always used to say there's so much history here, there's so many stories here, there's so many people that no one's ever heard of. Right. And I've tried to have some of them on this show. And over the years, you would see all these wrestling books and things, and some of them very, very good, but nobody, a lot of people, Tim Hornbaker is a huge exception, because his book on Capital Wrestling was incredible on this, but there's a lot of people that really avoided that. And you, in this book, you tapped right into it. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, it's a very, very different approach from other wrestling books.
Thanks. Yeah. And that was definitely my MO here. Was I wanted to tell the story, in addition to the main storyline, which is to what extent these guys became their characters, sort of secondarily, I wanted to look at how the WWF expanded in a pretty narrow time frame. Like, I, you know, this isn't the ultimate book on the history of the WWF. This isn't even the ultimate book on the history of the expansion. I think that book still could be written. There are people that would probably be better or more interested in that than me, but as it was relevant to the Backlund to Iron Sheik to Hulk Hogan title changes, I did want to tell like that 1983-84 getting up to WrestleMania 1 time period. And I always felt like talking to, as I said, the unsung heroes, the people behind the scenes, whether it was in merchandise or magazines or finance, they were all there. They knew what it was like to work with Vince McMahon when it was a very small company. But almost none of them had been spoken to publicly about it. You know, as you said, they were, most of the people that I interviewed for the book who were office people had not really talked before about their memories and their experience. So I was really happy that I was able to break some new ground, because it's hard sometimes in wrestling, or the perception is that it's hard to break new ground, because you hear the same stories told over and over again.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, as you said, that there aren't a ton of stories out there that still could be told. And like when you ask people that work there to come, are people generally willing to talk?
Well, obviously it goes without saying they have to be people who aren't there any longer.
Right.
Um, In fact, it's funny because I still on occasion will go to some of these happy hours and reunions and things. Because like I've said with people, it's almost like being veterans of a foreign war. Like you have this in common, whether you're still there or not. And so I will still occasionally cross paths with people I knew who are still there. And believe it or not, even though we just heard recently Sue Aitchison being let go, she was one of the longest running employees. She had been there since those days. Believe it or not, there still are a handful of people. No one knows who they are unless you work there. I mean, I wouldn't say they were. It's not the Ed Cohens of the world or the Basil DeVitos or the, you know, Liz DeFabios and people that were maybe the most high profile. But there's people there that will tell you crazy things. And I'm just sitting there at a happy hour and I'm going, this is insane.
This person knows this,
you know. I'll just say one thing. I remember that there's one person, I'm not going to mention because they're still there, but the most unassuming clerical kind of cubicle person, worker, you know, anonymous. But this person had been there going back to 1984.
Right.
Someone who is a Titan sports person, not a wrestling person. You know, I'm a wrestling person. But in talking to this person, they would say things like, oh, yeah, Vince, he was really wound up about this guy, I can't remember, something Gagne or something like that. And,
right.
And I'm going, Vern Gagne! Oh, my God. Because he'll try to play off like he didn't, like these people were all beneath him and whatever. But as it turns out, he was consumed with some of these guys and he would let his employees know. But I mean, those are the kind of things you hear from these people and it just falls off their lips. And sometimes they don't even realize the significance of it themselves.
Right. As an example, I got this picture of the Titan softball team from like 1985 or 86. And I was looking
Howard at Howard Finkel, the coach.
Right. One of the names, Tony Starson.
Yes. Someone Bob Collins' assistant.
I just looked up online and like, oh, this person, because I was wondering, like, what is this person doing? And she was started in July of 85 and still there, apparently.
So Tony Starson. Wow. What a name. I remember, all right, there was Bob Collins, who was the vice president, the senior vice president of, I forget what, I think it was promotions or something. And
when you were there or way back?
When I was there.
Yeah.
And he started in 1988 or 89, and his main role became the promotion of WrestleMania, which was like a year-round task for him, the promoting of it, the marketing of it. And Tony was kind of like his assistant. And it's funny. I mean, Bob, I'd love to get on here, but he's very hesitant. Very nice guy. Very hesitant. He used to work for Ringling Brothers Circus. Hmm. And he would have, because on Tony's door there, where you have the nameplate, because her name was Tony Starson, is Tony Starson. He did it as a pictograph. He had a toe, a knee, a star, and a sun. So that's the kind of guy that Bob was. But Tony Starson and Debbie Bonanzio, who was head of creative services, they were the two people that brought me to Freddie Blassie's house in Hartsdale, New York, when Freddie passed away, because his widow Miyako wanted to sell or go through a lot of his memorabilia. So they were these two company big shots, and they decided to bring along, you know, the wrestling maniac nerd who works in publications, because he'll actually know what the hell all this crap is. So I got to be in the car with Tony and Debbie going to Blassie's house. So, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, seeing those names, it just lights things up in my head.
You know, what's funny is, like, we, without knowing it, we overlapped in a way that in this book, the prologue is in 2005 when I go to live near the Iron Sheik to work on a biography. And at that point, so you were there at that point at WWE. Yeah. And the books were hot, right? Like the books division, like almost everything after Mick Foley, everything that came out was like a bestseller just immediately.
And every month they were trying to put out a book every month through Simon & Schuster, which is probably the only reason that they published my book, because they needed to fill a month.
What was your first book?
It was WWE Legends.
I remember that. Yeah.
Which I published in 2006. It was sitting, the manuscript was sitting on a shelf for 3 years.
Wow.
Until they were just like, what do we have coming out in February 2006? Oh, nothing? Okay, let's schedule this Solomon book, Legends, whatever this junk is. And that's really how I got the book published, because I didn't have any personality behind it, that's for sure.
So at that point, I'm 24 years old, and I'm very green. Looking back, I was not ready to write that book back then. And I was working on a proposal based on my time with Khosrow Vaziri, the Iron Sheik. And I remember I reached out to WWE, a guy named Dean Miller was the guy who like I had a phone call with. And, you know, I kind of laid out the idea and he was like, yeah, he's like, his only caveat was like, he's like, I hope he never like worked with Dave Meltzer. That was his, that's what he said. Like, we don't want anyone that's like, you know, working with Meltzer. And I said, no, I'm not, you know, part of Meltzer's thing. And then it never got to the point where I could submit the proposal because things went so sideways with Khosrow Vaziri. But right. so you were probably, was Dean Miller like in the same division as you or?
Yes. Well, no, but I worked in publications, the magazine department. Dean Miller, I hope I'm right about this because I'm friends with Dean. He'll correct me, but I believe he was a part of Consumer Products.
Okay.
And his job was to oversee the books. Before him, it had been a woman named Stacy Pascarella, who actually was the person who greenlit my book, which was Legends. But because the book sat around for so long, I wrote the book in 2003, as I said. By the time it came around to, hey, we're actually going to do something with this, a couple of years later, it was Dean who was in charge. And Dean was fantastic. Great to work with. I mean, they both were, but I mean, Dean really like saw it to the finish line. He was a great guy. But as you know, and as I mentioned earlier, before we started, I also was very close with Keith Greenberg, who was the other guy who was tapped to do this book. And I'm assuming and suspecting that a big part of why he got a lot further is that, you know, he was hooked up with WWE. He was a freelance writer. And he had a proven track record. And in fact, I think by that point, he had already done the Fred Blassie book, which from my money is the best WWE published wrestler biography. He did the Superstar Graham book. He might've even already done the Flair book, I think. And I remember hearing stories from him because he actually, as you know, he actually wrote it. And I mean, this is Keith's story to tell. You know, I don't want to get into too much detail, although I think he's talked about it a lot, but I mean, he sat with Khosrow and wrote the whole thing. And it became a thing where, it was so I mean, to be totally honest, it was so shocking that WWE didn't want to publish it. That's what it came down to. It was, you know, because it's a hard story to spin positively, especially back then. And they never like to get too down and heavy in the stories they tell. There's always got to be some kind of redemption or something. Right. And his story got very dark. And so there were actually two different points where WWE shelved it. They're like, we can't do this. And then a little bit later, for whatever reason, they were like, you know, we're going to give it another shot again. And they got Keith's hopes up and he's working on it again and getting it ready. And they're like, you know, we changed our mind. We're killing it again. And so this book never came to light. In a weird way, I sometimes wonder if I even would have been able to do my book on the original Sheik if this one had came out, because as with anything else, the Iron Sheik always overshadows the original Sheik, unfortunately. but you know, it's one of the mysteries of wrestling publishing. You know, if that book will ever come out, it's like, for people that know esoteric cinema, it's like the wrestling book equivalent of Jerry Lewis's The Day the Clown Cried. It's like the movie that everybody has heard about, the urban legend, and it's never been allowed to see the light of day.
Yeah, well, so here's some interesting, I haven't really discussed this anywhere else, but you're jogging my memory that when I went to, in early 2005, to work with Khosrow Vaziri on the book, this is before Keith comes in the picture.
Yeah.
I remember I was there when his wife, Carol, who I spent a lot of time with, they got the Legends contract. And the Legends thing was just starting at that point. And the Legends contract basically said that, like, you're basically giving the rights to all of your stuff to WWE,
right?
Which meant that the book, if we did a book, it would have to be done through them. And so the plan at that point, before things were just clearly too difficult to work with him, was to have me and potentially another writer to work on this. And when it just fell apart, it wasn't that long after that WWE was, you know, they wanted to do a book on him. And so Keith got the nod and I contacted Keith and I said, hey, here's my backstory. And I sent him my material. Like, here's my here's my proposal. Here's what I wrote. And, I think he was really grateful that I was willing to share all that. But for me, it was kind of like this necessary closing of the chapter. Like, I needed to let go. It was really hard for me to accept. And then it's just so weird how it all turned out that, 17 years later, I would revisit all that in this book and go back and see the Sheik again. I mean, I could never have predicted that, back when this was happening.
So when you were originally doing that with him, it was an independent book then. It wasn't going
to
be.
Yeah, it was, I came to him and said, hey, like, let's develop, a proposal. I had talked to an agent. I was, I wasn't that keen on working with WWE because I knew that they would want a lot of creative control over how it's presented. And, even if you look at the six pack, things may be changing at WWE, but they probably wouldn't publish that because it's dark in a lot of areas. Right. And it's sort of like in critical in certain ways. And so, the idea was not to say that it wouldn't happen through WWE, but let's at least see where it could go. But then when they were going to sign the Legends contract, that made it, that kind of hemmed things in.
Right. And I'm glad, it's very true about the involvement of the company, in a way, the book I'm writing right now in Gorilla Monsoon, he's someone who's very tied in with WWE corporate. I mean, a corporate guy, a team player, and someone who's beloved there. And I just know, this is going to be a very different kind of book. It's not like there are things that people don't realize about the reality of the relationship and how it wasn't always sunshine and rainbows and certain right. contentiousness and things, which I actually am going to bring up in a minute. But the Legends thing is so interesting because it's almost like Vince's way of, I've essentially colonized the entire wrestling world territorially.
Right.
Now I'm going to colonize wrestling history because I'm going to monopolize these guys so nobody could even talk to them besides me or get their stories besides me. Because I'll tell you, I think another reason why my WWE Legends book got published is because it was called WWE Legends, because they were starting the Legends program up in 2005-ish. Right. And my book, I think my book was actually the first thing that even had that Legends logo on it that they had just created. But that program was such a game changer. Just to give you a look inside the mind of Vince McMahon, one of the times I was around him, I mean, I was in the room when they pitched the Legends program to him.
Oh, wow.
I didn't expect this because I get stuck in there having to pitch magazine things to him and there'd be other things going on. And I remember it was one of the days, Vince was like, you catch him on a certain day, it doesn't, you're not sure what Vince you're going to get, right? This was grumpy Vince. And they put the Legends program proposal in front of him. And he's sitting there and he's looking at it. And as part of it, it's listing all the people that are going to be included in it, and this has been heavily involved with Jim Ross at the time, who was talent relations head, and he had helped pick a lot of the people. And I remember Vince was nonplussed is the best word I could come up with, because he's looking at people. Again, it's Vince McMahon's perspective versus Jim Ross's perspective. And I remember him looking and he's seeing people like Arn Anderson, Steve Kern, people that were important to the wrestling business, but maybe not that important to WWE's business. And he's going, what are these guys doing here? They never drew any money in the business. And then he goes, where's the Bushwhackers? Where's the Honky Tonk Man on this? And I'm thinking in my head, because I'm the stupid smart mark that somehow got into the company, I'm thinking in my head, A, I could sort of see where he's coming from his point of view, but B, every internet fan in the world and every observer reader would be like exploding with rage and fury to hear him saying these things. And I'm sitting here right next to him. And he gets on the buzzer to his assistant in the other room. I will not say what he said, but he said in rather uncomplimentary terms to please summon Jim Ross to his office so they could discuss this as gentlemen.
Right.
That's
a great story.
I've never told it, but it's one of those weird, I got a chance to be around him a handful of times, and you get inside that bizarre mind of that bizarre person. Yes.
What do you think? I'm sort of been thinking that you had that period starting around there at 2005, the Legends program through, yeah. I don't know, when the network went to Peacock, basically, where there is like this incredible push for nostalgia, right? They buy up all the tape libraries. They do 24/7, which was awesome.
Loved it.
And they really seem like, okay, we're going to go with this. And then all that's really fallen to the wayside. And I've heard, oh, that's because it just didn't generate enough interest or revenue. And that may be true. But now with Vince gone and someone like Paul Levesque, who seems to like the history, like I wonder if there's going to be a little bit of a opening up of that stuff again.
I hope so, because I was excited to see it. That was all exploding while I was there. When I started in 2000, this is another thing that got the book going, my first book. There was nobody cared about the history. It was like nothing, right. Especially because they were right in the middle of the Attitude Era. They're making money hand over fist. Who the hell cares about, you know, what happened 10, 20, 30 years ago, right? In fact, if anything, one of the hallmarks to me of sagging business of WWE in more recent years, not now, but in more recent years, was they could never shut up about the Attitude Era. Why? Right. Because that's when they were actually making money. But could you imagine being a fan of wrestling in the 80s and 90s, right? Watching WWF, and they won't shut up talking about the 60s and 70s constantly, right?
Right.
That didn't happen. Why? Because they were making tons of money. But I was glad to see it starting to change in the sense of embracing history, because I originally pitched Legends of WWE, or WWE Legends as it later was called, as a, you'll get a kick out of this, I pitched it as a trading card set originally. It wasn't even supposed to be a book. I said, you know, you got all these people that don't watch the product anymore. They're older fans. They love the old stuff. It's an untapped market, which at that time it was. I said, put out these, you know, it'd be like baseball cards, except with Bruno on it and Chief J Strongbow and Andre the Giant and George the Animal Steel, and do that kind of thing. And it just went nowhere. But then, like you said, they started getting into the phase of, we're going to buy up these libraries, video libraries. We're going to buy up these photo archives. I saw them wheeling them in on pallets, photos and memorabilia, just cards, letters. God knows what they have. People don't even realize what they have.
Right.
And so then they started thinking, well, we want to monetize this. We want to do things with this. Like the Dusty Rhodes, they got the entire Florida wrestling tape library and things, because they wanted to do stuff with Dusty Rhodes, because he started working with the company. They wanted to do a DVD, maybe a book, maybe a magazine. And so they went through that phase. But like you said, honestly, I think it is as simple as that. They discovered, as many of us have discovered, there's not a fortune to be made in wrestling history. There's a finite market for it. And some people are all about that. But when you're as gigantic as WWE, it becomes a drop in the bucket, and then you start to go, why are we even bothering with this? Why are we devoting manpower to it? But I hope that'll change, in the sense that, I mean, it's a way of bringing older fans in. It still is, and it could be a loss leader. It depends on if you take what view of the wrestling business you take, and maybe with Hunter it'll change. I don't know. I would love to see it. I mean, certainly they've been doing these A&E biographies, and things are fascinating. I mean, they're definitely – it's that WWE spin on a lot of it. But what I always say is, it's better than nothing. I'll take it. You know what I mean? I can sit there and criticize it and pick things out and whatever, but I still think they're very well done.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
But I want to ask you, so this is something I really want to dive into, and I resisted the urge to do it before we started recording. But I'm writing, as I said a million times, this book on Gorilla Monsoon, Irresistible Force. One of the key moments in the book, in his story, in his life, is the sale of Capital Wrestling Corporation to Vince McMahon Jr., to Vincent K. McMahon. And it's this hazy, murky, almost mythical event that transpired in the Warwick Hotel, this old school mob hotel in Manhattan in June of 1982. And it's like, to get a sense of what actually happened there and how it went down, it really is like archaeology. And like, for example, another book that dealt with it well was like I said, Capital Revolution by Tim Hornbaker, and he was able to get his hands on documents and things. But this book, you talk to Jim Troy. I have to mention that name, because Jim Troy was long gone by the time I got there. but he was like a company legend. He was like, you know that old SNL skit about Bill Brasky, where they're all sitting at the bar and there were a bunch of salesmen sitting at a bar and they're trading stories about this mythical guy who was like the greatest salesman ever, but he did all these crazy, ridiculous things like, well, you remember the time that Brasky did? That's how what Jim Troy was like in WWE at the time. And I'm like, who is this guy? I keep hearing things about him. And your book brought him to life. What I want to ask about is he talked about actually he wasn't in the room when everything went down, but he was in the building, which is close enough. He gets on a plane, a prop plane, with Vince and Linda. And I agree with you, Linda's role in this cannot be left out. She was absolutely crucial. They fly from Cape Cod into Manhattan with this briefcase, which I never knew about this before, with a down payment in it. Is there anything he told you about that day that didn't make it in the book? Because one thing that's interesting to me is by that point, by the time they get to that actual day, right, it would seem to me, everything's been ironed out. By the time you get to the point where you're putting pen to paper. Now, my understanding of things that I've gone through and talking to some of the families and things was it took a little wrangling to get to that day. Mm-hmm. Did you get any sense of that? Because it almost seems like from Troy's point of view that it was a very smooth transition, smoother than I think maybe it actually was.
I think that once it seemed like the day of it was smooth, but my impression from him was that it took a lot to get the money together, that, you know, they were scrambling, Vince and Linda, to even have the money for the down payment. Jim didn't, you know, he said that he basically hung out in the lobby while they did the transaction. And then when he went up to the room, everyone was happy. And he didn't volunteer very much beyond that when I asked him about it. And I don't know if that's because there just wasn't much to say, or if that he just didn't want to disclose something. But he didn't really say anything more about, you know, that particular day. I mean, I think that the picture that I got from talking to him and Bob McMullen, who was the CFO that came in a year later, was that financially things were kind of disorganized when it came to Capital Wrestling and the transition. You know, Bob McMullen talked about how when he showed up, they really hadn't consolidated, even though they had sold the company, Capital and Titan Sports. And so it was hard to know like what the revenue, you know, where the money was, and they didn't have a line of credit and the agents were still carrying cash in suitcases. Yeah. So it seemed like a really just a cash business, you know, at that point. And I mean, as they said, the point of carrying all this money in cash to the deal, you know, we know about that he had to make the next three payments within a year. I'm sure your book is going to, I mean, I didn't get really into the weeds on the finances and the deal and all that, but I know there's a lot of interest and speculation around how was that deal structured? Why did Vince Sr.'s partners sell for that much, but seemed like a pretty low amount given the company was, I think, valued around like 9 or 10 million before in the years around that, and it sold for 1 million. So, you know, I don't have a lot more I can offer there, but I think sounds like you're going to have a lot of good answers to all that.
Well, the thing about it that I've sort of been able to discover, and this is even one of the things that I've been very grateful for, is to have involvement from Gorilla's family. His wife, Maureen, his daughter, Valerie. And Valerie has been amazing. Like, I can just text her questions that off the top of my head and she'll answer me. It's great to have. But Maureen, you know, she's somebody who was right in the middle of things, in the sense that she was, you know, an adult at the time all this was happening. And she was, but it's interesting because, again, it's almost like a mob wife thing where there's certain things that they don't know because it wasn't discussed. But what I can tell you is, and this also came from talking to Gary Michael Capetta, who was the ring announcer, and was sort of a protege of Gorilla's. He helped get him started, and he was like Gorilla's ring announcer, essentially, for his shows. And he talked very candidly about how pissed off, to be honest, Gorilla Monsoon was leading up to and even after the fact, because there was a sense of that this kid, basically, to their eyes, had swooped in, and they never saw him that way. That's the thing. Like, as a lot of us know, in the early years, it was like, oh, it's Vince's son. That's the guy that was like selling paper cups or whatever the heck he was doing, right. Or that right. Evil Knievel thing. This was like the old boys club. And initially, when the shares were first set up in 69, when it was like Gorilla Monsoon, Phil Zacco, and then later Arnold Skolin got cut in a few years later, it was like this old boys club. Vince Jr. was not at that level of those guys. It was sort of like he was the promoter's kid, you know, and they never saw him in that light. So there was a sense of him being like this upstart. And it was, I have no doubt that by the day it actually happened, of course, things had been ironed out. But it was kind of a messy process. It was a process of Vince, the son, first having to get his dad on board privately, right. Father, son. And once he got his dad on board, then it was just like getting the other pieces to fall into place, because his dad had 50%. And once you get that, you can kind of, not 51%, but you can kind of strong arm the other guys to a certain degree. And so I'm wondering, for example, if you ever heard anything about, if Jim Troy mentioned anything about lawyers being involved in this process, because you have to imagine at some step of the process, it sounds from his recounting of it that there weren't lawyers in the room when they did all this, which honestly, I would be very surprised that there wouldn't have been lawyers looking over their shoulders. But again, it's pro wrestling, so, you know, it's not that surprising. But I'm imagining at some point, even drafting these documents up, there had to be lawyers involved on all sides.
Because Linda was a paralegal, and Linda had a good mind for, I don't think Vince liked lawyers at all, but I think Linda was the one that was thinking about legal stuff. And so I bet that there was some lawyer that looked at paperwork at some point, because also, you know, on the other hand, there's a certain naivete, I think, to the way they did business in those years where, like, I remember seeing as they expanded in like 84 and they started implementing new policies, like fans couldn't bring cameras to the shows and they didn't have outside photographers allowed from other, you know, because they were doing their own WWF magazine. And there were, and I found a bunch of this stuff, which I'm going to put on my website, thebradpack.com, like these internal documents that I was able to uncover from some of those years, like memos from Linda and Vince and talking about changing policy. And there are some of those, they kind of indicate that, like, the WWF was realizing, oh, we need to have copyright trademarks on these names and these things. We can't just use a theme song without paying for it. Like, you know, I think for a while there, it was almost like, you know, they just were just, oh, we don't, you know, they didn't understand that they needed to protect themselves more legally if they were going to do this big ramp up. And they very quickly, that's when they introduced like the boilerplate contracts, and they started trademarking all the names, and all that happens like really fast in 84. And I think Linda is probably the one who's pushing that hardest, because she really, you know, Vince, I think, had the vision. He had ideas. I want to do a TNT show. I want to have toys. But it seems like Linda was more nuts and bolts about a lot of this stuff.
Yes. And we knew, even when I was there, Linda was the person who was the top person corporate-wise in the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, she was essentially the person who was running Titan Tower, essentially, right. The best way I could think of to describe it. And Vince was the guy on the road. I mean, obviously, Vince was the boss of all bosses, but he was the guy who was on the road, who was running, who was doing the broad strokes and TV creative and working directly with talent and things. But the day-to-day, boots-on-the-ground office thing that was Linda's world. She was the supreme entity in that respect, and we all knew that. And in fact, her type, she was the real WWE president. I mean, you know, forget about Jack Tunney and all these other people, you know, that we heard about, right? She was the real person. But it's so true what you say about those early Wild West days. I mean, people our age, well, you might be a little too young. I don't know, because we're in that phase where, like, we're in that age where even 5-year difference is a big difference. But there are people like me who try to explain to younger fans the impact of Hulk Hogan coming out to Eye of the Tiger, and how, yeah, real American, sure, great. You never heard him come out to Eye of the Tiger. That was Hulkamania. But yeah, they didn't care. They just went out and they did whatever they wanted to do without any kind of structure or control in those early years. I was interested to find out in the book that the guy you mentioned, Bob McMullen, right? Is that his name?
Yeah.
That he's the guy who basically completed the absorption of Capital Wrestling Corporation into Titan Sports, how the two entities still kind of existed separately, even though Titan Sports owned Capital Wrestling Corporation.
Right.
Because there's actually an interview that with Gorilla Monsoon, Brian Last has actually put it on the 605 in the past, but it's the only interview that I have ever heard where it's just somebody interviewing Gorilla Monsoon at length about the business and things. And it's from a Philadelphia radio show. And there's this, we all know the sports radio callers, right? It's like a cliche, but this guy
especially calls in Philadelphia. Yeah.
Yes. This guy calls in and he tries to like get Gorilla. So it's March 1983 to give you the timeline. And he's like, yeah, I know what really went down. I know that you used to be an owner of the company. You were part owner and you sold your shares to Vince McMahon. And it used to be, I know what it used to be. It used to be the Capital Wrestling Corporation. And Gorilla, who he doesn't deny that he sold his shares. He's like, yeah, yeah, what, you know, sure, that's true. And in this very kind of laid back, dismissive way, he goes, by the way, it's still Capital Wrestling. Okay, that hasn't changed. And at first I'm going like, is he just working this guy? But now in light of what I read in this book, I'm thinking in my head that, first of all, that was true. Capital Wrestling still did exist in March 1983. And I'm wondering, were these guys like Gorilla sold a bill of goods? Like Vince Jr. has that famous line that he says where it's like, if my dad knew what I really had planned, he never would have sold to me. And I think you could probably say that about all those guys, that they didn't have a full understanding of what Vince, the son, had planned. And some of them had gotten a little hoodwinked.
Yeah, I think because Vince and Linda, they were kind of off in South Yarmouth, Massachusetts in like 79, 80, 81, 82, right? And they didn't move to Greenwich until I think the fall of 83, and they went to the Holly Hill Lane office.
Right.
So they're, you know, Vince is the announcer and he may go to the garden shows, but they're kind of out there running the Cape Cod Coliseum and trying to just manage a building. I don't know that, as you said, that the power brokers in Capital really, even if Vince said he had a vision, like, I mean, to his credit, Vince's vision was just really understanding the entertainment aspect of all this and the potential it had with the expansion of TV and marketing and merchandise. And like, you can say that but I mean, like, I don't know if people could wrap their heads around what that looked like until Vince actually started doing it.
Right. And I think also in the case of some of these people that were along for the ride, some of Vince Sr.'s people, and not even just the owners too, but even people like Freddie Blassie, Lou Albano, you know, people that were like, you take care of these guys for life, essentially. They fell in line. I mean, there's no other way to put it. They were loyal people. They were soldiers. I mean, that's the way a lot of them thought of themselves. I mean, there are allegories between organized crime and pro wrestling. And I'm not saying that these people were criminals. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying a lot of the mentality would be the same. Because I know, even on this book too, whenever you find out about some of the sordid things that were going on and the scandals and stuff, a lot of these guys, and we sort of look at it a different way today, and a lot of these guys, they put their head down, they were loyal, and they kept moving forward, and they weren't going to break rank and they weren't going to turn on people and that kind of thing, because like you were in this life and that's what you did, even if privately they were appalled or upset or didn't approve. Like, for example, I know from talking to his family that Gorilla felt this way, that he was privately really troubled, but publicly, not only did he not do anything, but he kept in line, but he would even become known for sometimes cracking these kind of inside jokes on the air about some of these things that were really going on. And I think for some of these guys, it was almost like a gallows humor to get by. Like wrestlers and people in wrestling can have a very dark sense of humor. I can testify to that. And it's almost it's not an endorsement in my mind. And I'm not trying to be an apologist, although maybe I am. It's just a way to get by. And
it's a coping mechanism.
To sleep at night, right? It doesn't mean that they approved of all these things. I can certainly tell you they did not. And I'm sorry, you were going to say something.
Well, so I'm curious, did Gorilla, did he keep like a lot of stuff from his career? Did he have notebooks and planners? And I mean, is there, because that would be great to help tell the story.
So I've been to Marine's place once. I'm going back over the summer, and I was there for a couple of hours. I'm going to spend more time there. There's definitely tons of photo albums, and he had a column for one of the Philadelphia newspapers, and there's clippings of every single column that he ever wrote. Nice.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Japanese memorabilia, because he used to go to Japan to wrestle a lot in his earlier years. And there's a lot of Japanese kind of tchotchkes and things that he brought back with him. I don't know if there's anything that's more kind of like paperwork related. That's a good question. You also have to wonder how much there even was in those days. It's like, again, like the mob, like you always hear, like they didn't keep records, right? They didn't write things down. Now, I know, for example, Phil Zacco, he was the treasurer. So Phil Zacco would be the guy who probably would have had a lot of that stuff from the Capitol days. He used to do the tax returns of the wrestlers, and things like that. And I remember I was talking to Vince about for Legends, which these are the benefits of working there. I actually got an audience with Vince. I was able to sit down with him, but that's because I worked for the guy. And I remember him talking to me about the breakup of the original shares. And he said something which was so amazing. And it's going to be in the book because I have the original interview. He's talking about how they broke up. You know, Gorilla had 20%. Zacco had 20%. And Skoland had 10%. And he said something like, well, they cut Zacco in, you know, because you got to keep the money guy happy. He was the treasurer. You have to make sure he's happy and satisfied because he's handling the money, you know. And so he had those kind of insights. But I don't know how much Gorilla would have had in terms of records and things, because he essentially was, a lot of people don't realize this, he was for a time the vice president of Capitol Wrestling Corporation. He was second in command under Vince McMahon Sr., which is, again, why you can understand some of his maybe disgruntledness over the way things turned out. But I don't know, you know, that job entailed producing TV, running the Gorilla position, as they say. You know, he had his own territory within, because the Northeast was almost run like a mini NWA, where different promoters had different sections. So he had like South Jersey and Delaware and parts of Pennsylvania and things like that. But it was run in such a non-corporate way that you have to wonder exactly what the roles of some of these people were. It's very like amorphous. You know, what were they actually doing? Like, what was Arnie Skolan doing? I know he ran the Westchester arena in White Plains, the Westchester County Center, I think it's called. And I know like he would count the receipts at the Garden and things like that. But, you know, he was a road agent. You know, again, like their roles were kind of like not as clearly defined as they would be later, you know?
One thing you might appreciate, one gem that I was able to get a hold of was from a former employee, was he found they were headed for the dumpster, but Vince McMahon Sr.'s planners.
I saw this from when you posted
from 63. And so I'm starting to put some of that up, scanning it and putting it on the Brad Pack. And I've I shared a little bit on Facebook because I just, some of it is fun to crowdsource and say like, hey, do you know who these guys are? Like, I, this is before my era, right? So it shows like the pairings and the matchups and the venues. And I've been cross-referencing it with the history of WWE.com website.
Great site.
And it's cool because like there's a whole, the first, I'm starting in January of 63, and like there's none of those shows are in that database.
Amazing. So
it's kind of the first record we have of, you know, unless you were to go back to all the newspapers from that era and if they were covered, but it's kind of neat to see. And of course, Gorilla's in those years. So that might be helpful, you know, in your research.
Yeah. I saw when you were posting some of those pictures of those itinerary books, and I can't believe, and again, this is me, and I've had this reaction so many times, like Jim Cornette talks about fishing out original Crockett Promotions master tapes from a dumpster,
right,
and preserving that. How in the world people could discard these things, I don't right. understand, to not recognize the historical significance. Like, you're working for WWE. When were these?
Well, he rescued it. He did have the foresight.
Right, but why were they? Were they thrown out in the first place?
Right. It was 87. So again, like, you got to figure in 87. There's very little thought of like history at all. I mean, it's just like, yeah. I mean, it doesn't excuse it, but I think people were not thinking in those terms at all back then.
Well, because I think another thing that doesn't get talked about enough, in the sense of what Vince did with the expansion, and I heard you talk a little bit about this with Jim, about how Vince was a lot more aggressive than the other people who had thoughts of expansion. Like, he was more aggressive than the Vern Gagne's of the world and the Fritz Von Erichs, who were trying to run areas, the Ole Andersons, where nobody was running, right? Anderson goes into Ohio and West Virginia because the Sheik isn't promoting anymore, and Vern Gagne goes to San Francisco because the Roy Shire territory is gone. But what I think is, what I found to be true, is that Vince only became his fully aggressive self in that sense after his father had died.
Mm-hmm.
So Vince Sr. died in May of 1984. The expansion was already like 6 months underway by that point. But if you look at a lot of those dates and where he was going, before Vince, while Vince Sr. is alive and is still talking to his friends and things, Vince is like that too. He goes to Los Angeles. There's not much happening there. He partners up with Mike LaBelle, who's like on his last legs. He goes to St. Louis. The promotion is dying there. He's in upstate New York, where they haven't had their own promotion in years and years. He goes to Detroit because there's nothing there. He doesn't really start busting heads until after Vince Sr. is dead. And I don't think that that's a coincidence, because like you had Vince Sr. constantly confronting him. I remember Vince even telling me this, where I've talked about it in the Vince McMahon Vice TV documentary, where Vince Sr., he had to have like a come to Jesus moment with his dad, where he was like, are you with me or not? You know, I'm going to do this. I'm doing this. You work for me now. Okay. Are we doing this or not? And he finally had to get his dad to come around. I think, you know, I'm not saying that he was happy that his father died. Of course not. But I am saying that when he lost his dad, that it opened up some doors for him business-wise to act in a manner which I don't know if he would have gone about it the same way if his dad had lived through the whole thing. I think it might have had the same result in the end, but I think there would have been a little bit more pussyfooting around than what he wound up doing.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
But I do think that that was his goal all along. I think it was just a matter of getting his foot in the door and finding out ways to do it, because he did get his dad on board, because his dad was with him when they went to the NWA convention in August 83, where they were like, hey, everybody having a good time in Vegas? By the way, we're all leaving. Sorry. Jim Barnett's leaving too. We're taking him with us. You know, that guy that books the NWA world champion. Yeah, that guy. He's coming with us. The guy that was running Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Right.
So, I mean, he's on board for a lot of that stuff. But I do think that the dynamic changes, like, you know, Bob Backlund's mentioned a lot in your book too. And Bob Backlund, again, one of those things people forget so completely. Bob Backlund was still there. He didn't just lose the title and ride off into the sunset. He was there through the summer of 1984. Backlund was on the card, the MTV card with Wendy Richter and and Fabulous Moolah.
The Brawl to Settle It All, was that the one?
Yes, that was his last show at Madison Square Garden. You know, he was there. Can imagine Bob Backlund being in that locker room, right? You can't even ponder it. But I think, again, Vince Jr. was trying to be patient with Bob and find him things to do because his dad was there, and his dad loved Bob Backlund, and Backlund was very loyal to his dad. Once his dad is not there anymore, I don't need you anymore, Bob. Unless you're going to turn heel and dye your hair black, right. We don't really need you. You know.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a great point. The timing of that, yeah, it does match up. Yeah.
But the other thing I wanted to bring up too is Sergeant Slaughter, and I mentioned this before.
Yeah.
Such a fascinating guy. Sergeant Slaughter wrote the introduction to WWE Legends. He did not have a computer. I don't even know if he had an email address.
Right.
What he did was he wrote the introduction on paper by hand and faxed it to me at the office from his personal
Was he a road agent at that point?
Yes, he was. When he came back in 1990 and he wrestled for like 2 or 3 years and then he retired, but he kept working there. So he became a road agent. I'm sure he did a lot more, but I remember like one of the things he would do is he would write out, they had this big eraser board by the gorilla position that would let everybody know what the rundown was for the show, what the matches were going to be, what the segments were going to be. And he was in charge of like keeping track of that. He would write it all out on the board. He would change it around when it needed to be changed. And I don't know, I hope I'm not wrong about this, I don't know if he actually agented matches directly, like Gurria was doing and Jack Lanza was doing, and later Arn Anderson or Steve Kern or people like that would directly work with guys. Fit Finley, he did all the women's matches. I don't know if Sarge was doing that, but I know he was always there. I mean, he was right there in gorilla position for years. But what I found so fascinating is that you found the same thing about him that I did, which is that he really is one of those last remaining people who tries very hard to hold on to kayfabe as much as he can, right?
Right.
Very protective of his real persona, his real name, things like that. Like, I'll give you an example of what I found, and maybe we could compare notes. When I was sitting down with him, because he was very easy to get for the book because he's a major WWE legend, number one, from the pre-even Hulkamania days, which is what my book's focus was. And he's right there. I'm at the shows, and he's sitting in a chair right over there. So that's how we started talking. And I remember he was laying down ground rules with me, and one of them was, like, we can't mention my real name, not even in the article that you write about me in the book. I don't want my real name in there. And he goes, maybe I remember at one point, I think he might have relented at a certain point, but he was very cautious about it. And he even said to me at certain points, his attitude was almost like, especially his last name. Like, he was okay with Bob because obviously we know his real name is not Sergeant, right? His first name is not Sergeant. There must be a first name there. But he essentially didn't want people to know that Slaughter was not actually his last name. So he was kind of okay with Bob Slaughter and things like that. He was very cautious about it. He didn't, for example, you know, we couldn't talk about the fact that he was not a drill instructor.
Right.
Very
Did he
cautious.
Even acknowledge that, though, even privately?
No. Well, again, like, there were certain things where he just wouldn't answer. Like, I remember I interviewed him too, because he's featured in the book in addition to writing the intro. Like, he was very cautious because also he still worked for the company. Like, he wouldn't come out and explain to me what, at that time, we know now, but he wouldn't explain to me what the issues were with Vince McMahon, why he left in 84. In the first place. And we know it was the G.I. Joe stuff and the licensing and merchandise and all that. But he was very, like, he was just sort of like, I don't think we should get into this. And we'll just leave it at this. You know, Vince McMahon and I had some disagreements and I walked out and that's it. And so he was very, very protective of things, which I guess you found as well. But I'm wondering if all these years later, if he's maybe a little less protective as what he used to be.
Well, I think so. I didn't get to sit down and interview him for the book. I mean, that was the story of that chapter, was me striking out and even going to his house and knocking on his door. And But I was able to piece together his story from talking. I went to Eden Prairie, Minnesota, where he grew up, and I met with his high school football coach and some of his teammates and friends from high school. And so I filled in some gaps that way. Also, he has done a couple of shoot interviews over recent years where he has been more forthcoming about the details of some of the things he mentioned. The one thing he would never admit publicly was that he didn't serve. And I guess just in the last few weeks, you know, in the A&E biography, I don't know if you saw that episode, but they bring that up and he does admit, you know, he's like, yeah, I didn't serve, and basically said, I won't claim that again. But his excuse was that he was always considered himself to be in character doing any interview publicly the last several years, which to me doesn't quite add up, because there were parts of those interviews where he would be very much out of character. And then right. It was, you know, where it was convenient, he wanted to claim that he was in character. So what's interesting about your Bob Slaughter thing is that that doesn't surprise me, because when he first created the Sergeant Slaughter character in 1976 in Kansas City, which was interestingly the same time that the Iron Sheik character was being created and tested in Kansas City, and that's when they got to know each other, he was advertised for shows as D.I. Bob Slaughter, things like that. It wasn't even Sergeant Slaughter yet. So that was, and he did have the foresight to patent and trademark the name Sergeant Slaughter at some point in like 77, which is why, and I talk about that in the book, in 84, when Vince is trying to say, I own you, you know, Slaughter comes with his lawyer and says, nope, like, here's paperwork that says I own the copyright. And that, you know, no one was pushing back on Vince that way at that point, other than Jesse Ventura, I guess, a little bit later. But
yeah, well, also, I mean, he could claim that he had already created that name and it had it before he came in. Like, that's a reason why Roddy Piper could always be Roddy Piper. You know, his name wasn't Roddy Piper. Right.
But and he was with Bill Eadie. I talk about this, that in that lawsuit, you know, he in one of the letters that Vince wrote to Bill, which I have a copy of, you know, he says, we created and promoted the team Demolition. But if you've heard Randy Colley and Bill Eadie talk about it, you know, they, while Bill Eadie was still one of the Machines and Randy Colley was one of the Moondogs, it was actually Randy Colley that drove the whole idea, who was Moondog Rex. And he, you know, he and Bill developed the team Demolition, the name, the look, brought it to Vince. Vince loved it. But then he rewrites history and says, no, we created that.
Right. Well, that's part of, again, that's the Vince attitude. And I know, like, you and Jim talked a little about how Vince would always find like some type of loophole that would give him an excuse to do something, and that would help him to rationalize it. But he would, you know, he did have this belief that it falls in line with what I know is like, well, it happened under my watch, so it's mine. It right. happened, you know, you guys worked for me, or, you know, you brought this to me, or whatever it is, I own it, it's mine. That's just sort of like the general attitude. And the thing with Sergeant Slaughter, like you said, and, you know, he already, that was fully formed before he ever came
right.
to even the original run when he came in, I guess, 1980 or so. He already had that. And the DI thing is fascinating, because he told me that, and I guess this was maybe partially him admitting that he wasn't really a drill instructor. I don't know. He didn't directly disavow it, but he told me that a big inspiration for the character was the movie. There's an old movie with Jack Webb that's called The D.I., which some people may know. I think it's from the 50s, where Jack Webb plays this, Jack Webb from Dragnet, right? Just the facts, ma'am. That guy. He plays this hard-ass Marine drill instructor. And Sarge told me that he was like laying around watching this movie on TV one day, and he was just like, damn, that would be a great gimmick, you know? But the weird thing is, we didn't, I guess, the concept of stolen valor, right? That's been around forever. But for some reason, I just think, like with many other issues of cultural sensitivity, right? People just weren't as widely aware of it as they are today. This idea of, like, you do not claim to have performed military service if right. you didn't actually perform military service. And it's one of those weird fuzzy spots of wrestling, because nobody would have a problem with, you know, Jack Nicholson being an army general in For a Few Good Men. And how could he claim to have served? He never served. Because we get that he's playing a part, but because in wrestling, they right. try to blur the lines and they live the character outside of wrestling and that kind of thing, then it becomes a little more suspect. But those old school guys, they really felt like they needed to do it to preserve their marketability, like the other book I did on the Sheik. And I firmly believe this, if he was right, if people knew that the Sheik was actually Eddie Farhat from Lansing, Michigan, a World War II vet, that he was Catholic, all this stuff. Right. Yeah, he came from Syria. He was Arabic, but he was Catholic. His appeal would have died. His marketability as a main event heel in the 60s and 70s would have become a joke. So right. I understand, but you're living in a different time now, and you sometimes have to let go of some of these things.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But he is a tough nut to crack, isn't he? Reading your stories about getting him and not getting him. Made me feel a little better, because yes, I got him for Legends, because again, we worked together and he was sitting 10 feet away from me, but there was no dice as far as getting him for this Gorilla Monsoon book, because I had
Did you try to get him?
I tried, and that yeah. got nowhere. So I sort yeah. of felt like, all right, well, it's not just me, at least, you know?
Yeah. Well, in your research, I mean, of course, a lot of guys are probably passed away, but are you finding it tough to get people, or are people being forthcoming and, you know, willing to talk to you?
So I'm running into some of the same things you did, and I always have run into this, where some people won't look at you without getting paid.
Right.
And I can't really do that, because, you know, ECW Press has a policy where they don't pay for any interviews, and there's always a fear. And I know, even when I worked for WWE, there was, when you get some of these old guys to come in for things, like if you pay one of them, you got to pay everybody.
Right.
And you don't want word getting out, because then the other guy goes, well, I heard you paid this guy this. Are you going to give me? So I've never gone down that road. And yes, it's cut me off from some things. Like
right.
I was not able to talk to Abdullah the Butcher for the Sheik book, which would have been a gimme. I couldn't talk to Sabu, his nephew. Those people were cut off from me. For Gorilla, it hasn't been as bad. There were a couple of people. I don't know if I'm ready to mention who they are. I feel I don't want to expose them, but
sure.
There were a couple of people who wouldn't talk to me. One of whom I was really bothered by, because he's somebody. It's one thing to be somebody you were in the WWF locker room when Gorilla was there, and okay, fine, you don't want to talk, whatever, you want to get paid. But there was somebody who was really directly involved who knew Gorilla's son Joey very well, and who died in a car crash, and who had. Sure. Would have had direct insights on that, who just wouldn't do it. And it's one of those things where if they start paying people, forget it, because ECW, the kind of operation they run, there's no, they'd go out of business. But that's how some of these guys are. Speaking of the Iron Sheik, this is a funny one. When I worked at WWE, we did a magazine on all the greatest wrestling villains of all time, a special magazine. And we had past and present guys. And we did a photo shoot in a warehouse in Utica, New York, where we dressed them all up like prisoners. And we did like a prison lineup.
Yeah.
These are the things you could do.
I remember that. Yeah.
So like Vince did it. We shot Vince and Shane separately. They didn't come to the photo shoot. But Vince is in this thing. Randy Orton, Edge, you know, they were like current guys. We had Iron Sheik there. Roddy Piper, Ric Flair did it. So, and there were others too. But so now it can be told. We paid the Iron Sheik. He was the only one, because he would not do it without getting paid. Luckily, we didn't have to pay him in crack. We paid him in money, which was good. But we were so nervous, because we remember thinking, oh my God, if these guys find out, they will kill us.
Well, it's interesting that Slaughter's agent told me that the WWE is paying him now to do these A&E things. So like, I don't even know. I mean, I think that when you look at the A&E shows, it may be that some of these guys are getting paid. And of course they're not disclosing that. You know, that was always my solution for my own conscience was, if I'm paying, I'm going to disclose it to the reader that I'm doing that.
Oh yes, absolutely.
But,
you should.
But to me, it's troubling if these guys are getting paid for talking on a documentary and that's not being revealed, or, you know.
Well, that's WWE. That's that kind of thing. But I'll tell you what, you know, I know for a fact, when I see that Sabu is in a thing, or Abdullah the Butcher is in a thing, whether it's Dark Side of the Ring or anything, I'm going, all right, they paid them. There's no
right,
way they're because I know there's no way they're going to do it without getting paid. And it's unfortunate in a way, because I think the older generations, meanwhile, the people who didn't do tons of interviews, they looked at it in a very different way. Like, you know, these guys get paid to go in halls of fame. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, who pays people to go in a hall of fame? Because everything is a payday. Everything is this carny payday. You know, in the old days, things like the Cauliflower Alley Club or the Wrestling Hall of Fame, the original one in New York and upstate New York, and these guys were just honored to be there.
Right.
Bruno Sammartino would come there and be honored to be there. And I think that's something that's changed over the years. And I don't blame anyone necessarily. It's just changed. Like CAC, it used to just be like a warm reunion. It was like going to the Elks Lodge, you know, getting to see your pals once a year. And these things slowly tend to become more like wrestling conventions, you know, paid appearances and things. And it's just, I guess it's just the changing nature of the business. But yeah, some of these people, that's, they're taking stories with them to their grave because no one is willing to pay them to hear those stories, which is unfortunate.
Right.
But with my book, I thought I would have loved, like, there's not a lot of people that are still around who were, let's say, in the locker room before the sale, even working for the McMahons and seeing Gorilla in his full power running the Gorilla position. You know, I tried to get Don Morocco, and he didn't want money, but he was just too busy relaxing on the beach in Hawaii to just want to. And I don't begrudge him that one iota. I can respect that more than saying, like, well, how much are you going to pay me? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But it's tough with some of these guys. But you did a fine job with this book in terms of what I loved about it, and I think what makes it work, is that the book, and this is also what the Wax Pack is like too, the book is also the journey. It's not just here's a bunch of facts, here's the history, here's what I collected. It's here's the process of how I actually got all of it. And I think that is what makes it stand out, and why, you know, people should check it out, because it, like I said, it is unique. It is different. It isn't like any other wrestling book you've ever read, even books about these specific people and this specific time period. It's a very different kind of book.
Thanks. Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's also why, like, the Wax Pack was really hard to get published. I mean, it got rejected 38 times and, years of struggle. And I was told by agents and editors and everyone, you know, well, there's too much of you in the book, or the players aren't famous enough, or like this style that I have of blending memoir with travel, with baseball or wrestling and history, as you said, taking the reader on the ride in the process is not something that's done that often anymore. And, you know, and so I think a lot of publishers are very risk averse with that. But I think that is what, and just like with the Six Pack, it kind of what makes it different than most other wrestling books is that it's very much the story of getting the story and my sort of first person account of being out there.
Well, it's a very journalistic approach. It's a very personalized journalistic approach. And here's another Gorilla Monsoon connection. So Tom Wolfe, the author and also journalist, he kind of pioneered in a lot of ways this very like personal journalistic style.
The new journalism.
New journalism. This very like, I'm like you said, I'm inserting myself in this and I'm giving it character. I came across in the 60s, apparently, I guess he was like working, I don't know if it was Associated Press or something, might have been some New York paper, one of the 8,000 New York papers they had. They sent him to the Garden to cover wrestling, Tom Wolfe.
Oh, wow.
And he did his fully new journalistic approach of slice of life. Here's the people I talked to. Here's what the matches, you know, he like tracked the wrestlers kind of sheepishly walking down, you know, 48th Street to their hotel with their briefcase in hand, things like that. But that, I guess, I don't know. It's sad when you say that it's a tough sell nowadays, because it used to be common sense that that is a very captivating approach and a very captivating way to tell the story. Like, I've always felt, and we see this with memoirs all the time, that if you tell a compelling story, the story itself is the hook. You don't necessarily need to be the most famous person in the world. Right. We've seen people that write memoirs about themselves and their families who are not even noted public individuals.
I think what it is, it's like memoir is very popular, and straight history is popular, but it's like, it's that blend that is less common now. And, you know, that could be a whole nother podcast about why that is, but I'm glad I'm able to, you know, continue to do those. So.
Yeah, I think so, because it should. One of these days I might do a book on some of the interviews I did that have never seen the light of day. Yeah. I would you give me hope. The fact that that they greenlit this book gives me hope, because those things, like you say, I can back that up. It's a tough sell. But again, I want to mention to people the name of the book, The Six Pack on the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. Check it out. And the last thing is, I just want to ask you to just reiterate for people, fill people in on, I know there's a website as well, and how people can follow you and what you're doing and the additional content and that kind of thing.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm on Twitter, Instagram at Brad Pack Books, and the bradpack.com is the website where you can get access to these internal documents. And I'm also putting up some of the raw audio. So if you wanted to hear, Brian, the Jim Troy conversation, you know, putting that up there. And so, you know, you can kind of get the deleted scenes and the bigger picture behind the interviews.
I will be checking that out. Especially if that Jim Troy one goes up there, I will be listening very intently.
Yeah, I put part one up last week. And I think I got two parts up there now. So, yeah, it's up there.
I just love when new stuff comes to light about things that wrestling fans have talked about forever.
Yeah.
And there's actual new information. So your book's full of it. I mean, full of new information, I should say. Your book is full of that new information that people like me are looking for. So again, Brad, thanks so much for taking the time out to do this. I loved it.
Yeah, thank you.
There you have it, folks. My conversation with Brad Baloukchian. Brad, thank you so much for coming on the show. And once again, I encourage people to pick up Brad's book, if you haven't already, The Six Pack on the Open Road in Search of WrestleMania. And as Brad mentioned, you can find out more about him and about the book at the website, thebradpack.com. And I hope you keep listening to Shut Up and Wrestle. Always big things in the works, as I hope you realize by now. And next week, boy, is it a big one, because it is going to be part one of a two-part From the Archives interview that I did with the late, great Rowdy Roddy Piper. This is an interview I did with Roddy in the fall of 2006 when we were on site in Utica, New York for a photo shoot for a special edition magazine that we were producing. And I spoke to the man for so long about just about everything that it's, you know, it's an almost 2 hour long interview. And so I'm going to be breaking it up into two parts. He talks about wrestling. He talks about his legacy. He even talks at length about They Live and how that movie happened and everything about it and all that good stuff. So I hope you tune in next week. It's going to be episode 120. And then the following week, episode 121 will be part two. Other great things in the works, guests in the weeks to come. I will have the second edition of my WWE Employee Roundtable, which this time we will have participating former Shut Up and Wrestle guests, Melissa Costabile and Johnny Photo, aka John Giamondo. And we'll also be adding Dave Barry, who was a member of the Creative Services Department. That's coming up, as well as a very special and personal episode with my own lovely wife, Jamie Smith Solomon, that I think you will find both refreshing and disarming. That is coming in the weeks ahead, as well as Vince Fahey, the founder of Kayfabe Memories, and Kevin Kelly, the legendary play-by-play commentator, coming to Shut Up and Wrestle in the weeks to come. So stay here, keep listening. So many places you can find the show. Our website is suawpod.com. And you can also find it wherever you find your podcasts: Spotify, Podcast Addict, Podbean, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, all the usual places. While you're at it, do join the Facebook group, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. And if you're inclined and you want to make a small, modest financial contribution to this free podcast, you can do that in a couple of ways. On my Twitter page, Brian R. Solomon, you'll find a button there at the top with a little dollar symbol where you can donate via Venmo or Cash App. And if you'd like to use PayPal, you can find me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. Once again, want to mention the Patreon. To find all the Shut Up and Wrestle commentaries that are going to be coming, you can go to patreon.com/shutupandwrestle. Some of the other projects I work on: the Wrestling News. Find it at thewrestlingnews.com or the YouTube page for Arcadian Vanguard. Subscribe to it if you like. We put out a new one every single morning. The books I've written: Blood and Fire, the unbelievable real-life story of wrestling's original Sheik, as well as my most recent one, Superheroes, the history of a pop culture phenomenon from Ant-Man to Zorro. If you're interested in purchasing a signed copy, reach out to me once again at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. The magazines that I write for, as I mentioned at the top, Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Get it in print and digital form at pwi-online.com. And there's also Inside the Ropes magazine, which you can get in print and digital form at insidetheropesmagazine.com. If you're looking for me on social media, you will find me on Twitter or Instagram at Brian R. Solomon. My Facebook author page is Brian Solomon Writer. And on any of those social media platforms, you will find the link to my website out on the World Wide Web. Shut Up and Wrestle is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And as always, this has been Brian R. Solomon, asking you to keep those cards and letters coming in and reminding you that outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. And inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. So long, wrestling fans.